Did you ever wonder how one of the most powerful empires the world has ever seen declined? Why did it give up all its territories? How did the global American empire come to pass, and the British empire, which at one point spanned the entire globe, more than a quarter of the Earth's land surface? The sun never set? Well, that is the topic of Imperial Obituary by Major General Richard Hilton. And in this video, I'm simply going to read a chapter from this book. And I thought you'd be interested to hear some of the details therein. So it's pretty hard to get hold of this book. There could be a couple of PDFs floating around. I'm not sure. You can find that in your own time. This is chapter 9. It is called The Process of Betrayal. Starts on page 97 if you'd like to follow along at home. The late Mrs. Nesta Webster, in her book The Surrender of an Empire, has disclosed very fully and with ample documentation the influences at work against the British Empire up to 1931. There is nothing that need be added to that scholarly and conscientious study within its chronological limits, but much, very much indeed, has happened to the British Empire since her book was published. I should mention in passing that this was published in 1968 by the Britain's Publishing Company in Devon. Okay, let us continue. The most disquieting fact of British history in recent years is the fact that the British Empire emerged from the Second World War territorially intact, with the one exception of Ireland, and with its prestige enhanced rather than diminished, despite its financial straits and its early disasters. Intelligent world opinion, particularly in Europe, recognised that, if it had not been for the British in 1940 and 1941, Nazism would have conquered the world. In 1945, British prestige and influence among the nations was as high as it has ever been. The first shattering blow was the unnecessary, or at any rate the disastrously premature, withdrawal from India under Mr. Attlee's post-war government. This was quickly followed by the surrender of the Palestine Mandate, again by the same Labour government, and I went through some of the details on that on the Cigar Stream earlier this week, so check that out if you're interested. Another book by Richard Hilton called The 13th Power was in focus on that occasion. But apart from these scuttles, the British Empire still remained in being when the Conservative Party commenced its 13 years of power in 1951. During those 13 years of government by this right-wing party, whose declared policy till then had always included the maintenance of the British Empire, the entire empire was disintegrated. It is reasonably certain that a vast majority of voters who put the Tories in power in 1951 and did so in the firm hope and belief that the dissolution of the empire started in India by the socialists would cease forthwith. Sir Winston Churchill had told Mr. Roosevelt a few years previously that he had not been appointed Prime Minister of Great Britain in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. It was reasonable for voters to suppose that the party he had led shared its great leader's sentiments, particularly when it is remembered that the Conservative Party manifesto for the 1951 election had contained no hint whatsoever of any intention of destroying the empire. The debacle of the 13 years from 1951 to 1964 constitutes an act of betrayal by the right-wing leadership of Great Britain, an act of betrayal for which the right-wing electorate as a whole must forever carry a great deal of blame. Mrs. Webster's book has shown clearly how left-wing politicians and intellectuals had for many years worked with this destructive object in view. She has shown clearly what people with practical experience of India and Africa had always known, that the humble masses of the people in those lands had no desire whatsoever to terminate British rule. Even the chief exponents of imperial disruption realized this themselves and frankly admitted it. Mr. E. Samuel Montagu, Secretary of State for India in 1924, and the left-wing viceroy, Lord Chelmsford, in their notorious Montagu-Chelmsford report on the Indian political situation, made use of these astonishingly candid words. This is a quotation from that report. They, that is, the masses of India, after experiencing British rule, sank into a condition of lethargic content. As for the idea of self-government, it is simply a planet that has not yet risen above their horizon. Now we have to tear up that faith by the roots. We have to bring about the most radical revolution in the people's traditional ideas of the relation between ruler and ruled, and it will be a difficult and even dangerous business, for it is neither safe nor easy to meddle with traditional ideas in India. The number of Indians who really ask for free institutions does not exceed 5% of the population. But we are not setting about to stir 95% of the people out of their peaceful conservatism and setting their feet upon a new and difficult path merely at the bidding of the other 5%. Our reason is the faith that is in us. We believe, this is still from the report, the official report, remember, by the Viceroy of India and the Secretary of State for India, part of the British Imperial Administration. This is them writing, not Mahatma Gandhi or an Indian nationalist or anyone like that. We believe profoundly that the time has come now when the sheltered existence which we have given India cannot be prolonged without damage to her national life. That the placid, pathetic contentment of the masses is not the soil on which such Indian nationhood should grow, and that in deliberately disturbing it, we are working for her highest good. These words ought to be recorded in every book, this is Hilton again, that aims to study and explain the world's social and political upheavals. For here we have, in the very words of two prominent intellectual progressives, their confession of faith and their excuse for taking a contented and well-governed country and plunging it into the unrest and intimidation which culminated 23 years later in the massacre of unknown millions of Indians' pathetically contented peasantry, Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs, butchering one another wholesale. And why? Because the British had abandoned their sacred trust of governing India well. Because of a train of events set in motion by two foolish idealists, Messrs. Montagu and Chelmsford. And why did these two idealists embark upon this dangerous course of action? We have reason in their own words. It was because of the faith that was in us. It is not because they thought the Indians wanted to be self-governing. Oh no, these idealists knew quite well that Indians wanted no such thing. It was done simply to prove to these two political dreamers and others like them that their pet theory was worth a practical trial. For this, they destroyed the British Raj in India and condemned millions to massacre and misery. Terrible as it is to realize that there exist such people who can cause such havoc just to try out a dangerous dream, it is at least understandable that left-wing intellectuals, by their very nature, must be expected to behave in this way. The antidote to subversive activity by left-wing intellectuals should be, and normally has been, up until modern times, a counteracting firmness on the part of right-wing intellectuals in defence of good government, stability, and plain common sense. From the left must always be expected dangerous and cranky experiments, surrenders of authority to mob rule, and a tendency to courage, comfort, and help in every instance the enemies of Great Britain. From the right, our country and the empire ought to have been assured of a stalwart defence of all that was being undermined by cranks and enemies. The surrender of an empire, about which Mrs. Webster wrote, had in reality hardly begun in 1939. The empire still stood capable at a heavy price of saving the free world from Nazism. The acts of betrayal which she described were almost exclusively the acts of left-wingers. She was spared the grief and humiliation of seeing that supposedly patriotic party, the Conservatives, bringing the whole imperial edifice crashing down to the ground in the space of 13 shameful years. Why did they do this? It is a question that need not be asked in the case of left-wing empire breakers, but there must have been a deep and perhaps sinister reason for Great Britain's former pillars of the empire to continue and even to hasten the work of disruption commenced by the left-wing Little Englanders. Not one of the reasons commonly put forward by conservative apologists is worth a moment's consideration. They have said it was done in response to some compelling clamour for freedom expressed by the subject races of the empire. There has never been any such clamour. Even the left-wing idealists Montagu and Lord Chelmsford knew that this was nonsense. Some have said that this surrender of empire was, quote-unquote, inevitable, either because of this alleged clamour for freedom by the millions, or else because of the irrepressible guerrilla warfare which movements such as the Mau Mau of Kenya or the Ioka of Cyprus were able to carry out. The first of these excuses needs no answer, as there has never been any spontaneous popular clamour. The second comes nearer to the truth, though still it is invalid as an excuse for surrender. It is true enough that in many parts of the empire, terrorist gangs have given British security forces considerable trouble, and at the same time have succeeded in producing a plausible appearance of anti-British public feeling by intimidating the ordinary people to act this part. Besides the Mau Mau and Ioka already mentioned, there have been the Fenians and Sinn Féin in Ireland, and the Band Mataram in Bengal, the Red Shirts in northwest India, and the Communists in Malaya. To say nothing of less notorious but equally effective terrorists elsewhere. Intimidation by gangs of terrorists was, it will be remembered, a distinctive feature of North American unrest in the early stages of the revolt of the 13 colonies. And if you pick up the book, he has a whole chapter on that, which is chapter 4. It is significant that the Fenian Society and other Irish terrorist organizations started among the Irish Americans of the United States, and that American aid and moral support have in recent years frequently been given to anti-British terrorism. This form of guerrilla war is admittedly very difficult to handle, but there is no doubt whatever that it can be handled and suppressed, given a sound plan of action and determination on the part of the forces of law and order to carry the plan through to the bitter end. Communist operations of this kind in Malaya were stopped by Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templar. Lord Kitchener put an end to the guerrilla warfare of the Boers by his system of barbed wire and blockhouses. Ruthlessness will always stop guerrilla war. At the other extreme, kid glove methods invariably fail. There is always, however, a happy mean between undesirable brutality and excessive squeamishness. and British commanders and their troops can be relied upon to find the effective answer if only they are given the task by politicians and then left to carry it out. But this has never been the way of British politicians in the latter years of imperial decline. Cyprus was a case in point. It has been reported that the total casualties suffered by British troops during the Eoka campaign amounted to about 400 killed. If this figure is even approximately correct, it must surely have been the first occasion in history when a great power has accepted defeat in a war after suffering only such trifling casualties. To say this cast no reflection upon the troops or their commanders. It was the British government, and not the fighting men, who gave up the struggle and allowed Grivas and a few terrorists to kick the British out of Cyprus. Mr. Harold Macmillan, in his notorious Winds of Change speech, sounded the knell of white rule in Africa on the grounds that black insurgence was irresistible. Yet Portugal, militarily a much weaker country than Great Britain, has up until now, that is 1965, defied both Mr. Macmillan's gloomy warnings and the worst that the freedom fighters or terrorists of black Africa have been able to do in Angola, Mozambique and Portuguese Guinea. If Portugal could do this, why could we not do the same in Kenya? Need a great imperial power really have been driven out by Mau Mau, a few savages armed with only pangas? Apologists for scuttle on the argument of force majeure forgot that a few hundred white mercenaries have marched all over the seething Congo Republic and wherever they went have restored to that gigantic country the only vestiges of law and order to have been seen there since the Belgians left. When they find force majeure an untenable argument, apologists for scuttle fall back on the moral argument that it is not right for white men to rule over the coloured ones. It is not just, they say, that a minority should rule over a majority, regardless of the relative competence or incompetence of the respective groups to run a country. Majority rule has been elevated by left-wing propaganda to the status of a sacred religious fetish, to which even such eminent Christian divines as the Archbishop of Canterbury bows down. If these ardent worshippers of majority rule were asked whether it should apply to a kindergarten school where the teachers are outnumbered by the pupils, they would presumably say no. Yet these same left-wingers are at this moment trying to coerce the white minority of Rhodesia to hand over control of that highly developed country to people whose intellectual equals have been shown what a mess they could speedily make of the Congo. If you're wondering, incidentally, Rhodesia later became Zimbabwe, so it did turn out to be a mess, didn't it? When driven to abandon their defence of the untenable theory of majority rule, the apologists fall back upon their final ditch. They claim that, even if the undeveloped peoples may make a mess of governing their country, it is, after all, their own country, and they want to be, quote-unquote, free. In most cases, this alleged longing for, quote-unquote, freedom is a figment of left-wing imagination. If, indeed, it is not a deliberate lie. Our politicians must have known, unless they are imbeciles, that the ordinary masses of Asia or Africa are not interested in self-government. Montagu and Chelmsford knew this about India 40 years ago. British politicians of today have no excuse for imagining that popular feeling in undeveloped lands has changed in this respect. During the 13 years of shame, when a Tory government was organising the breakup of the empire, official instructions were issued to district commissioners, and similar officials in charge of colonial territories that were to tour their districts and give instruction to the people about the independence which would shortly be given to their country. In Nigeria, when a young white administrator delivered an educational talk of this kind, in accordance with orders received in his words, they were heard by the simple countrymen with horror and dismay. Horror and dismay. They protested loudly that they had no wish for this promised freedom. They besought him, as a representative of British rule, not to leave them. Much the same experience was encountered all over the empire when young men in charge of districts, in accordance with orders received from an exalted source, tried to reconcile their flock to the prospect of being left without British rule. However complacently Whitehall politicians may live in the clouds, it is incredible to think that no mention at all of the real reactions of the colonial peoples have come to the knowledge of Whitehall. Yet they persisted in forcing severance from the British upon unwilling recipients of this boon. Besides multiracial India, there were in the empire smaller territories with multiracial communities. Fiji was one of them, with its original Fijian population vastly outnumbered by Indian immigrants. Mauritius was another. Here again, a huge influx of Indian immigration had swamped the Creole French, that is, the Mauritians, whose homeland, the island, had been for generations. In British Guinea, there was similar tension between Indian immigrants and the descendants of African slaves, to say nothing of a third racial group, the original American Indians. I think he's talking about the American Indians. In Cyprus, the Turkish minority dreaded the Greek dominion, which independence would bring. In all these cases, there was strong opposition from an important part of the colony against termination of British rule. And yet, knowing all this, and knowing the lack of any real desire for independence among the undeveloped peoples, British politicians obstinately persisted in forcing independence upon one unwilling community after another. We may well ask why. It is difficult to avoid the conclusion that in their otherwise unaccountable conduct, the Tory government of 1951 to 1964 must have been acting under outside pressure of some sort. This suspicion is greatly strengthened if we study the sequence of the early surrenders of British interests. The first incident was that of Aberdeen. Not, of course, a part of the British Empire, but certainly a vital British interest created out of almost nothing but sheer British enterprise. The Aberdeen crisis had already commenced during Mr. Attlee's government, but the situation was still in hand and could have been saved when the Tories assumed power. HMS Mauritius was in the Persian Gulf, within easy reach of Aberdeen, and a brigade from India lay in readiness at Basra. Public opinion in Persia and Iraq fully expected firm action by the British to follow this show of force. But at the last moment, the British climbed down in response to American pressure. The situation drifted from bad to worse until eventually, after prolonged negotiations conducted by the Americans, an international consortium took over what had been an exclusively British enterprise and kindly allowed the British to keep 40% of what had recently been wholly theirs. Americans took another 40% and acquired a controlling interest in the refineries. A few years later, this blow to British prestige was followed by an even more serious one, the Suez Affair. Again, it was pressure from the outside that influenced Sir Anthony Eden, later Lord Avon, the British Premier, into calling off the Suez operation in a humiliating way, when, on the brink of success, it was America, again, that played a leading part in this anti-British action. There is little doubt that the Tory politicians of 1951 to 1964 were acting under foreign influence of a very compelling nature during their liquidation of the British Empire. And there is little doubt that this influence was American. Did this conduct of British affairs by British politicians acting under foreign influence constitute a betrayal of the trust imposed on them by their sovereign and by the British electorate? History will one day judge them. Meanwhile, it can scarcely be denied that it would have been considerably more honourable for the Tory leadership in 1951, assuming that they were indeed under intolerable foreign pressure, to have taken the British electorate into their confidence and told the British nation openly that they were being compelled by American pressure to liquidate the British Empire. That almost certainly would have been the course taken by Sir Winston Churchill if he had still held the reins with his old-time vigour. In 1940, when things were as black for Great Britain as they had ever been, he spoke out openly to the people, concealing nothing. "We had our backs to the wall then," he told us, in no uncertain terms, "blood, sweat and tears. The British people responded to such candour and resisted all that the enemy could do. They would no doubt have done the same in 1951 if the Conservative Party had told them candidly that another enemy of our country, recently and still nominally our ally, was forcing Great Britain into paths disastrous to our British future." But the British public were never told the truth. No mention of a coming liquidation of the empire figured in the election manifesto of the Tory party. No hint was given in the next few years under a Conservative government that our country was going to open its gates to a torrent of coloured immigration, which, as any child could foretell, would inevitably change the national character of the very people who had built the empire, thus doing their best to ensure that Great Britain could never rise again. The voters were never told that our country had its back to the wall, just as desperately as in 1940, though our enemy of 1951 still posed as a friend. Instead, the electorate was lulled by the fatuous parrot cry that our country had, quote-unquote, never had it so good. When a few patriots, alarmed at such portents as the smooth situation of the word Commonwealth for Empire, and then the quiet omission of the prefix British, began to ask questions, they were pacified with another parrot cry. "The empire is not breaking up, but simply growing up," they were told. It is at this point that all of us, who ought to have known better, must begin to shoulder a share of the blame. We ought not to have been deceived. Aberdeen should have made the danger clear. Suez should have aroused the patriotic portion of the electorate to immediate action. Churchill's remark to Roosevelt concerning liquidation of the empire, already fairly widely known to the thinking public, should have left Britons in no doubt as to America's intention toward the empire and the fact that their plot existed as far back as Yalta. It is true that a minority of enlightened patriots did their utmost to sound the alarm, notably the League of Empire Loyalists, but already nearly all the machinery for public instruction had passed under control of Great Britain's secret enemies. A campaign of derisory vilification was launched against a few who were alert to the danger and who dared to try to rouse the mass of complacently orthodox conservatives. In the minds of many fox-hunting, bridge-playing county families, good fellows all of them, and lifelong Tories, any criticism of the party leadership seemed nearly as bad as blasphemy. to raise funds for the party by whist drives and the like, to canvass the countryside at election time and to keep the socialists out. These were all that should be expected of Conservative supporters. As to questioning the reasons for giving away the empire or the wisdom of mongrelising the British nation, there's not to reason why. It simply was not done. Admittedly, it required courage in those days even to hint that our great ally America seemed to be playing rather an anti-British game. It was hard enough for decent Englishmen even to allow such a horrible thought to creep into their own inmost consciousness. This difficulty still persists and is due to mental confusion on what exactly is meant by America. Many of us during the war were personally fortunate in the Americans alongside whom we fought and with whom we formed cordial friendships. It is impossible to believe that such good fellows as those could stoop to treacherous conduct against their wartime allies. This, of course, is quite true. There are probably over 95% of good, decent, honest Americans whose friendship and admiration for Great Britain is genuine and lasting. But America is an enormous nation, and there are quite different kinds of Americans. Furthermore, as in other modern democracies, what the powers that be do frequently differs widely from what decent citizens would like them to do. A very large number of American books have been published, such as None Dare Call It Treason by John A. Stormer, to warn the American nation itself, with fully documented proofs of the extent to which the United States government had been infiltrated by communists and other sinister influences. There is almost as much disquiet among patriotic Americans concerning the un-American conduct of their own government as there is among patriotic Britons concerning the anti-British behaviour of the State Department, Washington. Therefore, to recognise the painful truth and to declare that the United States government is being manipulated by secret enemies of Great Britain is in no sense a reflection upon decent Americans. Actually, there is no cause for surprise that anti-British feeling exists in America. Unfortunately, it dates right back to the War of Independence. It manifested itself in the unsuccessful American attempt to seize Canada in 1814, when Great Britain had her hands full in the Napoleonic War. This lingering antipathy towards the former mother country was intensified during the 19th century by the influx of Irishmen who left their own country because of the troubles with England. This flame of anti-British sentiment continued to be carried across the Atlantic by fresh Irish migrants, even up to very recent times. But the true source of anti-British thought lies deeper in the American community. One cannot read such books as None Dare Call It Treason, with its documented accusations against prominent American statesmen and officials, people whose names have won respect in Great Britain, without feeling that men of this calibre simply could not have been traitors or villains of their own accord. One forms an unescapable impression that these important and prominent men can have been nothing more than political puppets whose movements and deeds have been controlled by hidden wire pullers behind the scenes. America is a land of immense wealth. A predominant share of this wealth rests in the hands of a comparatively small number of men. On this exalted level, finance becomes international, or rather, it has always been so. New York happens today to be the home of international finance on a grand scale. The men who manipulated it may indeed live in America and call themselves American. But their outlook, their ambitions, and their plans are international. It almost automatically happens that this immensely powerful community, living as it does in America, uses the weapon close to its hand, that is, the American nation, to carry out that powerful community's plans for the future of mankind. these plans necessitated for the start of the downfall of the British people and the destruction of their empire. There is no secret about the influence exercised by international finance. Its manipulators are so sure of themselves that they boast openly of their power. The late Mr. Bernard Baruch, for example, at the end of the First World War, announced that he was attending the peace conference in London so as to, quote, hold the big stick over the big boys to prevent them from fouling up the peace. By the big boys, he meant the statesmen of the Victorian Allies, men with authority to speak for their own countries. By the big stick, he meant the power of money, since he owned no other authority. Mr. Baruch had never been elected to represent any country or party. He just represented international finance. This, then, was the background to the betrayal of the British Empire. At the bidding of the wire pullers in America, our ally pursued a policy consistently anti-British from the moment that the war ended. If indeed they waited as long as that. American influence, backed no doubt by international finance, projected itself upon British politicians, starting upon those of the left, but quickly extending its grip to those of the right also. The craze for destroying colonialism, always a pet subject with Americans if the colonies belonged to someone else, was adopted as a serious policy for the reconstruction of the whole world. Backed by international finance, American statesmen bulldozed statesmen of other nations into acceptance of their views. Not only the British Empire, but those of the French, the Dutch, and the Belgians were also destroyed by an American mixture of financial pressure, aid to rebel movements, bribery of indigenous bigwigs, and above all, pressure of some mysterious but highly effective kind upon the statesmen of Britain, France, Netherlands, and Belgium. Synchronized with this political attack, American pornographic literature, American films, American comedians, and American lecturers assiduously undermined the moral standards of the British people. British outlooks on religion, purpose of life, duty, marriage and divorce, sexual moderation, commercial honesty, and even sport were all ridiculed as quote-unquote square or quote-unquote old-fashioned. Publications of books or articles supporting robust outlooks on British history or on the rights and wrongs of colonialism were squeezed out of print by financial pressure on newspapers and publishing houses. Such British history as was taught in British schools tended towards glorification of America and slurs against the British historical record. In 1957, a boy at one of England's best prep schools disclosed that the only British battle that he remembered hearing about at school was the Battle of New Orleans, rather an obscure sideshow of the Anglo-American War of 1814, in which particular action a British force was defeated. The fact that the United States failed in its main war aim, the annexation of Canada, had not been deemed worthy of mention, any more than the fact that the British had captured and burned the city of Washington. In short, the undermining of British national pride, sense of historic values, spiritual and moral stamina, and all other ingredients of national greatness has been stealthily carried out for many years as a well-planned operation of psychological war. At the same time, emissaries of the American CIA or of the State Department Washington have travelled about the world, putting spokes in the works of British colonial administration. The egregious Mr. Menin Williams, an offensive troublemaker in Africa, was outstanding among many others. All of this was the work of an anti-British organisation, working through a foreign power and was therefore morally justifiable as an operation of power politics, though it is a trifle unusual, perhaps, for any one nation to treat another in this way while still posing as an ally. However, by moral standards of international morality, neither Americans nor the wire pullers behind them can be blamed for their anti-British activities. By those standards, it was legitimate, and it was very efficiently done. We can but give them admiration for their skill. The indignation of British patriots should be reserved not for foreign enemies of our country, who have only behaved as enemies normally do, but for British right-wing politicians, who must have seen all this going on, who for 13 years had the power and responsibility of defending our country against such attacks, but who made no attempt to stop it, if indeed some of them did not actually aid and abet this enemy action. One more example I give. The flooding of Great Britain with coloured immigrants started in the form of financially assisted passages for West Indians, the fares being paid by foreign moneylenders. It quickly became clear to Britons of ordinary intelligence, who had studied the results of multiracialism in other lands, that this new development, if unchecked, would eventually destroy the whole character of the British nation. Yet the leaders of the Conservative Party, far from acting against this danger while it was still easily controllable, actively encouraged the invasion, and to this day persist in minimising the danger, advocating integration and smearing as racialists or extremists those patriots who dare to protest. If the Conservative Party leadership had not been guilty of a deliberate betrayal of the trust placed upon them by their Queen and by the electoral supporters during their 13 years in office, at least they cannot be acquitted of a gross dereliction of duty. It is beside the point to mention that the other parties, being further to the left, might well have done far worse damage to our British future. It is in the nature of left-wingers to do so. By infiltration of the Conservative Party with the defeatist ideas of the left, by invasion of the party leadership and the Conservative central office, by men of left-wing mentality posing as Tories, the task of restoring Great Britain to health and vigour has been rendered immeasurably more difficult. No political party today believes in Great Britain's destiny or cares whether she degenerates to the status of a third-class nation. Not one of the three big parties. The Tories, traditional defenders of the nation and empire, have abandoned their post. It is left to the few old-fashioned patriots, without funds, without aid from the press or the BBC, if not indeed against opposition from these agencies, to save the situation. The Conservative leaders of 1951 to 1964 will have a serious charge to answer at the bar of history. There you go. That was Major General Richard Hilton. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm currently doing a sale on at the Academic Agency. Promo code MATE. That's MATE with three A's. MAATE. I have also just released my book, The Prophets of Doom. Pick it up now at Amazon, or if you don't like Amazon, choose another bookshop or buy it directly from the publisher. All right, so long for now.